This week we pull ahead here in Eretz Yisrael for about a month or so, having had just the 7 days of Pesach. Parsha Shmini was a couple of days ago, and we already find ourselves considering the Parshas of Tazria and Metzora. We will meet at the pass, I believe, of Behar and B'chukosai. That will be the grand unifier. Until then, there's a discrepancy of a week. Tazria and Metzora, of course, deal with the complicated halachas of Negoim, of Tzaras. In fact, they have a reputation. Negoim and Ohalos. Negoim, Tzaras, and Ohalos, the way that a mace conveys Tumah via being in the same room as someone else, they are the two classic difficult disciplines of halacha. If you wish to say that a person is an expert in halacha, until Negoim and Ohalos. And there is a most interesting comment of the Medrash with regards to a pasuk from Tehillim. We're familiar with it, we say it the whole time. And the pasuk is, it's from the end of Perek Yutes, Yehiyu l'ratzon imrefi. That's how it begins, Ve'egeon libi lifanecha, Hashem tziri b'goali. Yehiyu l'ratzon imrefi. May the words of my mouth be l'ratzon. And the Medrash has a very interesting comment to make with regards to David's intention with these words. Yihyu l'ratzon, may they be l'ratzon. Which ratzon specifically? Says the Medrash, Omar David lifnei HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Yihyu ratzon. And this is the Yihyu l'ratzon. Yihyu ratzon. Shekola osik b'tehillim imrefi. My works of Tehillim that David HaMelech wrote and compiled. Some of it was written before him, but compiled. Kola osik b'tehillim yihye ki'ilu osik b'negoyim. May it be considered as if he is involved in the halachas of negoyim. That seems to be a rather enigmatic statement. And there are a number of comments that are made on this medrash that open up very interesting discussions for us. This medrash is referenced firstly by Reb Chaim Volozhin in the Sefer Nefesh HaChaim. Nefesh HaChaim was a work written by Reb Chaim, of course, one of the primary disciples of the Vilna Gaon. It was a response in large to Chassidus. And he took issue with various matters that he felt were mistakes made on the part of the approach of Chassidus. He wasn't shy in writing it. They weren't shy in responding. And Shar Dalet is devoted to the issue of Talmud Torah, the mitzvah of learning Torah. And specifically, the ideal that we call Torah Lishma. Torah Lishma is what everyone aspires to learn. Of course, there is a concept of shelo lishma, one learning for ulterior motives, but for the altruistic lishma, that is the goal that everyone is driving towards. And the question is, what is the meaning of Torah lishma? How is it defined? And as we know, one of the primary differences between the Hasidic approach and the Misnagdish approach, for want of a better word, although the hardcore Misnagdim will consider the Hasidim to be the Misnagdim, but in any event, is the role of intent, the role of purity of intent over precision of action. In other words, the diktuke halacha, and to do exactly what's what, in terms of the materials and in terms of the physical parameters, as opposed to the idealistic intent that goes with it. What are the relative roles of those two things? And of course, the Hasidim laid enormous emphasis on the area of kavana, sometimes even delaying, and this was a sticky point and remains so actually, delaying sometimes even past the time of tefillah to ensure that the tefillah would be just so, whereas the The Misnagdim, of course, said, well, I mean, that's wonderful, except it's no longer Tefillah. You missed the time. What about Torah Lishma? The prevalent approach in the time of Reb Chaim, the Hasidic approach, is that the goal of Torah Lishma is Torah whose learning is about bringing a person closer to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. That is to say, that defines the atmosphere and defines the conscious goal of the learning. That is what a person should have in mind when they learn. And that being the case, there are a number of ramifications. First and foremost, subject matter. What should you choose to discuss? What should you choose to learn? According to the Hasidic approach, if the ideal is Torah Lishma, so the ideal, if the ideal of Torah Lishma is feelings of closeness to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, then the ideal subject matter should be subjects that are conducive to those feelings. As opposed to perhaps the more technical and mundane areas of halacha. On this point, Reb Chaim took great issue, for he felt, amongst other things, that if only those areas were focused on, other areas of Torah would be neglected and in time completely forgotten. And in any event, he felt that that was a mistaken understanding of what the idea of Torah Lishma was about at all. Rather, says Reb Chaim, Torah Lishma is a person who is learning Torah for no other reason than to understand HaKadosh Baruch Hu's will in every area of Torah, whatever it may be. And what's important to appreciate is that the difference between the Hasidim and the Misnagdim here is not whether or not the goal of learning Torah is to bring about a closeness with HaKadosh Baruch Hu. About that they all agree. The question is not whether that is the goal. The question is whether that is at the forefront of one's consciousness and whether it is the accompanying atmosphere to one's learning of Torah. According to the Hasidim, it has to be part of the consciousness at the time, whereas for Reb Chaim, of course, it is the overriding goal. But what you're thinking about at the time may be many other things. There's many areas of halacha, says Reb Chaim, and if a person needs to know all of halacha, not all of halacha is conducive to feelings of closeness to HaKadosh Baruch Hu at the time that you're involved in the halachic discussion. After all, if one goes through the halachas of Choshen Mishpat, Hilchos Torin V'nitan, litigation in a Bezdin, that's criminal law. In order to catch a criminal, you have to think like a criminal. And the Gemara says, in order for a dayan to be a good dayan, he needs to know which one of the two plaintiffs or the two litigants are lying. Says Reb Chaim, at the time that the dayan is wondering whether or not the person is his claim is suspicious or doesn't sound right, or could he have said a better lie, or is it, how good a liar is he, etc., etc., that's not a time that a person feels particularly close to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. If he does, he'll probably get distracted and make a mistake in the Psak Din. Rather, there is the overarching goal of coming closer to HaKadosh Baruch Hu through fulfilling his will in each and every halachic scenario as it plays itself out. And in that Beis Din setting, he should have nothing on his mind at the time other than which one of these two people in front of me is a liar, and how can I tell? And as proof, we've given something of a background to this discussion, but as one of the proofs of Reb Chaim, is this medrash with regards to David HaMelech. For consider what David said. There's two areas of Torah. One is called Sefer Tehillim, and one is called Hilchos Negoyim. There is no greater area of Torah that is conducive to feelings of closeness to HaKadosh Baruch Hu than Tehillim. It's Torah, and that's what it's all about. It's written by David HaMelech, it's Divrei Chassidus. Negoyim, on the other hand, are extremely particularistic and technical, and they're very hard. And also they do not deal with matters of closeness to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And lo and behold, we find that David is asking, may it be that one who is reciting Tehillim should be considered as if he was involved in Negoyim and not the other way around. As if to say that the ultimate expression of Torah Lishma from David HaMelech's point of view is that the will to fathom Ratzon Hashem should be expressed in every area of halacha, even in that of Nagoyim. And that is Torah Lishma. So this is a very interesting nugget from this explosive machlokus, really, which reverberates in many other areas of life between these two different approaches. And this was the role of the Medrash in this matter. A very interesting angle on this words of the Medrash again, David HaMelech says, may one who recites Tehillim be considered as if he's involved in Negoim. What does that mean? Why Negoim specifically? So there's a wonderful interpretation from Rav Meir Simcha of Divinsk, the Meshech Chochma, or Samer. And he directs our attention to an interesting aspect of Negoim. Namely, a person becomes Tomei. Should it happen? Should a person have Tzaras? They only receive attain the status of Tomei when pronounced as such by the Kohen. Until that time, they may have all the symptoms of Tzaras, but they're not Tomei yet. In fact, it comes to a fore when a person has something that looks like Tzaras in their house. And even if it's definitely has the makings of Tzaras, so they go to the Kohen and they say, looks like Tzaras to me. And the Torah says, take all of your things out of the house before the Kohen comes and pronounces it Tomei, because prior to that point, it's not Tomei. So save your things while you can, otherwise you'll be all day in the mikveh making Torah, that which can become Torah. So until the Kohen says that you're Tomei, you're not Tomei. Okay. Now, interestingly, what happens if the Kohen himself is not proficient in the halachas of Tzaras? He doesn't know. He knows he's a Kohen, but he doesn't know that you're a Metzora. So what do we do then? Next to him is an expert in Tzaras who happens not to be a Kohen, but he's a world-class Talmud Chacham and an expert in Negoyim. He followed David HaMelech's advice and investigated Negoyim. So the halacha is that the Kohen turns to the Yisrael Talmud Chacham for guidance, as if to say, is this Tzaras? And the Talmud Chacham said, yes. And the Kohen turns back to the person and says, you're Tomei. In other words, without the pronunciation of the Kohen, the effect has not happened. And of course, one of the lessons that we learn from this, and it's by no accident, the Chofetz Chaim talks about this, is the Torah is teaching us the power of speech, the inherent power of the spoken word, whereby certain things attain a new aspect of reality when people speak about them. And of course, that's what Lashon Hara is all about. And in a sense, this is something that's experienced by the Metzora himself. What's in a word? I said it. What difference does it make? And then he comes to the Kohen, and the difference between the Kohen saying you're Tomei or not changes your life until further notice. Says Rav Meir Simcha, Negoim therefore is a halachic mashal for the inherent power of the spoken word. And now let us come to consider Sefer Tehillim. David HaMelech composed Sefer Tehillim. We cannot begin to fathom the intent and the meanings and the layers of understanding that were imbued into Sefer Tehillim by David HaMelech. And the truth is, Jewish people, from that time onwards, when in times of trouble or crisis, or we turn to Sefer Tehillim, with what in mind? To say Tehillim. Says the Or Sameach, do we presume to fathom all of the things that David HaMelech intended when he composed Tehillim? We don't know. We can't know. We do our best, but we don't know. The question, therefore, is, do we need to have that understanding in order for the words of Tehillim to have their effect? And this is the request of David HaMelech. When he says, may Yehi Ratzon, may it be your will, that in future generations, anyone who is involved in Sefer Tehillim, may it be like they're involved in the Negoim. In other words, what David HaMelech is asking is, as surely as there is an inherent power vested into Nega'im, whereby when the Kohen says it's Tame, even though he has no depth of understanding, but there is the latent power of the spoken word, may that power exist also within Tehillim. The inherent power that David HaMelech invests within those words. And it's a fascinating idea, because in a sense, there's a cover letter with Sefer Tehillim. That we say the Tehillim with as much kavanah as we can, and we're like the Kohen in a sense. We don't know everything, but we know the words, and David HaMelech has asked that they should have an effect on our behalf. It's interesting to note that a similar concept, which is, it's a very interesting discussion, the inherent power of words of tefillah, exists with regards to the Shemona Esrei. The Gemara tells us in Maseches Megillah and Daf Yud Zayin that the words of the Shemona Esrei were composed by the Anshei Knesset HaGadola. And the way that the Gemara, the men of the Great Assembly, those 120 at the time of the beginning of the Second Commonwealth, and the way the Gemara describes them is Me'a ve'esrim, people of Anshei Knesset HaGadola, uveinehem kama neviim. Amongst them were a number of neviim, which is true. The last of the neviim were in the original Anshei Knesset HaGadola. They are Haggai, Zechariah, and Malachi, and Ezra. And Reb Chaim of Elojin, elsewhere in the Nefesh HaChaim, asked a simple question. Why do I need to know that some of them were neviim? That's very nice. I mean, it's a very good credential. But the Shemona Esrei comes from where it comes from. Does it make a difference that they were neviim? And the answer, says Reb Chaim, is yes. Because in a sense, the words of the Shemona Esrei are the ultimate expression of what the Jewish people are asking for from HaKadosh Baruch Hu. In that way and in that order. And in order to fathom the most potent combination, the ideal tefillah, the ultimate tefillah, that will be relevant and effective for every Jew, every day, in every place, for that you need Nevuah. It is most material that amongst those that were metaken the Shemona Esrei, Beinehem Kama Neviim. Because nothing short of Nevuah can provide you with the formula. Of course, the Jew now needs to provide the Kavana, but the Guf HaTfilah needs Neviim themselves. And it's a very similar idea to what the Or Sameach is discussing with regards to Tehillim, whereby, as much as, of course, personal tefillahs one can always add on, they are an augmentation, but never to replace the Shemona Esrei, because Shemona Esrei is what Nevuah says is the quintessential tefillah for the Jewish people. And it's interesting to note that there was an addition to the Shemona Esrei many years after the original Shemona Esrei. That's when Shemona Esrei became Tisha Esrei, and still we call it Shemona Esrei, because the bracha of V'lamashinim, Birchas Haminim, which was instituted as a response to and in order to oust the early Christianity, Birchas Haminim. Minim is the way that the Gemara refers to the early Christians. Nuslach Ashkenaz has the bracha of V'lamashinim without the word Minim in it, because of Minim. Because every Jewish book in Europe and in Christian-dominated countries fell under the knife of the censor. And the Minim themselves took the word Minim out of Birchas HaMinim. And all that's left are bad Jews, B'la Malshinim, Kol HaRisha. But so it's actually the absence of the Minim in Birchas HaMinim is due to the Minim. But how did it come about, and who composed it? So the Gemara says in Maseches Brachos Daf Kaftes, Rabban Gamliel, this is in Yavne, this is now post Beis HaMikdash, he asked, is there anyone who could be metaken this bracha? And in the end, their eyes fell on Shmuel HaKotan, of Pirkei Avos fame, but Volayevcha Al Tismach, Shmuel HaKotan, he was the one that instituted Birchas HaMinim. And the question is, so of all people, why Shmuel HaKotan? So Rav Kook said, I heard from my father's Zatzal, Rav Kook said that the reason why Dafka Shmuel HaKotan is because he said, "Benfolayev chal tismach." In other words, a person should not take personal delight in the downfall of their enemies. And therefore, his entire life had that altruistic way of relating to the downfall of evil. It wasn't a personal thing. It's very difficult to write a bracha of Olam Alshinim without having certain people that annoy you personally in mind. And that takes away from the purity of the composition. And therefore, it's specifically Shmuel HaKotan. He could be relied upon to compose completely, to use our earlier term, Lishma. But the Brisker Rav explained that the Gemara tells us in Masechah Sanhedrin, in Daf Yud Aleph, that it was known that Shmuel HaKotan was ro'i, the Gemara says this about him, was ro'i to have Ruach HaKodesh descend upon him, were it not for the fact that he lived in a generation which was just post-Ruach HaKodesh and the atmosphere did not allow for it. But him as a person, he was ro'i for Ruach HaKodesh. And therefore, says the Brisker Rav, that's what's necessary. In order to add a bracha to the Shmona Esrei, the original 18 were composed by Nevi'im. And now you're looking to add number 19? You need the closest thing you can get to Nevuah. And the closest thing was Shmuel HaKotan, as per the Gemara in Sanhedrin. So this should give us renewed appreciation for the words of the Shmona Esrei, where they come from. And of course, once again, they're not a substitute for our Kavana, but they are a powerful combination. The ultimate formula devised through Nevuah together with Tefillah B'Kavon. So these are some sentiments with regards to that medrash about Yehiyula Ratzon Imrifi HaTehillim should be like Negoi. And with that introduction, let us come to discuss the halachas of Negoim themselves. We won't cover all of them. We're actually going to focus on one of them within the context of a most fascinating episode that took place as recorded in the Gemara. Background. One thing we need to know. One of the Maros Negoim, the conditions of Taras, is called Baheres. Seis, Apachas, and Baheres. The words we know. That's not our problem. Baheres from the word Bahir, the skin becomes much brighter, brightly colored. And within that, two of the hairs that are not normally white turn white. Okay, that's Baheres and Se'ar Lava. Now, the final thing we need to know is that for various reasons, the Nega, this condition, will only be Tame if the skin turned bright before the hairs turned white. What we call Kodma Baheres Le'Se'ar Levan. First, the skin has to change color before the hairs. But if the hairs change color first, then he's Tahor. Now we know. Okay, what does this have to do with us? Well, if it goes one way, he's Tame. If the order is reversed, he's Tahor. And what if you don't know? We don't know. He woke up one morning and saw both, and he doesn't know which came first. Sofik. This is discussed by a Mishnah in Maseches Negoim, at the end of the fourth perek, and it's a machlokus, would you believe? The first opinion says he's Tame. If you don't know, he's Tame. But Rabbi Yeshua says, no, he's Tahor, which is interesting, because normally, in matters of doubt with regards to Torah law, one would err on the side of stringency. He's Tahor. Why? So the Talmud tells us in Maseches Nozir, Daf Samachay, that Rabbi Yeshua's point of view is based on the final pasuk in Parshas Tazria. It's very interesting. Just want to open up the Chumash at least once this evening and read the end of Parshas Tazria, which says as follows. It's a pasuk of summation, Perek Yud Gimel, pasuk Nun Tes. Zos Teras Nega Tzaraas. This is it. This is the law of the affliction of Tzaraas. Beged Atzemer, or Apishtim, or Ashati, or Ere, different types of clothing, O Kolkali, or Letaharo, O Letamo. To make pure, or to render impure. Says Rabbi Yeshua. It's a fascinating drasha. The Torah mentions letaharo before letamo. in order to teach us that when it comes to matters of tzaras, we are inclined more towards letaharo than letambo. Letaharo gets precedent. That's a very interesting drasha. And therefore, when in doubt, says Rabbi Yeshua, tahor. Okay. This will bring us to one of the most unusual episodes, I would say, in the entire Talmud. And it's to be found in Maseches Bav Metzia, Daf Pei Vav Amud Aleph. And it's about Rabba Bar Nachmani. And Rabba is, of course, quoted extensively in the Talmud. And this is actually about how he died. And it begins by the fact that he was wanted by the authorities for sedition. The reason being that twice a year he gave the Yarchei Kala, those shiurim that were open to the public, and they were attended by everyone. They were mobbed by thousands of people in Elul and in Adar. For those 2 months, which were also tax-collecting months, no one was at home. Because everyone moved to where Rabba lived. And therefore he completely disorganized the collection of taxation on a regional level. And it didn't take long before someone suggested that he was doing it on purpose. And he was wanted by the authorities, and he was running for his life. Okay, that's the background. And now, says the Talmud, we'll read a few lines. I have to read it from the Gemara, otherwise you may not believe it. Orak, he ran away. The Ozal Agma, he went to a forest. He's hiding in the forest. Have Yosef Agirda de Dikula. So he sat on there on the stump of a palm tree. And what do? In other words, he's run for his life. He's ran as far as he can. And that's it. So it's just him, the Kagoris. So he starts to learn. I mean, what else is there to do? So he's learning. And at that point, Kamifligi b'misivta derekia. There was a machlokus in the heavenly academy. About what? About the following halacha. In Baheres kod malase ar lavan, with regards to Hilchas Negoim. If the skin gets brighter before the hair turns color, tommy. Im sear lavan kodim le Baheres, if the hairs change color first, tohor. Sofik? And what if we don't know? I guarantee you will never hear a machlokas like this again. HaKadosh Baruch Hu Omer, Tohor. God says Tohor. V'kulu Mesivta D'Rikia, but everybody else in the Beis HaMedrash there, in the Heavenly Academy, Amri Tomei. Apparently they're yet entitled to their opinion. Okay. So it's a standoff. V'Amri, and they said, Man Nochach, okay, Machlokas. I don't know, what are you going to call it? Machlokas Rishonim? I don't know what to call it. Who will settle it for us? And they said, Nochach Rabba Bar Nachmani. Rabba will paskin. Because Rabba was known to be an expert in Negoi. Okay. So they're looking for Rabba. Now Rabba, in the meanwhile, is running for his life. Shavru Shalicha Basrei. So Rabba's time had come to leave the world, and he was actually at this point, his presence was requested in the heavenly academy to settle the halacha. But lo havamatzi malach hamavis lemekrevle. But the malach hamavis, of course, he's learning, and as long as he's learning, malach hamavis can't chap him. Midelo kaposik pume migirse, because he didn't stop learning. But then, okay, the malach hamavis, he's resourceful. Ad hochi noshav zika v'avish beinikani. So a strong gust of wind blew. It rattled the branches. Savar gunda de parshi. He thought that the enemies had arrived who were looking to hunt him. Amar teinach nafshei do gavra v'le yimasa biyada do machusa. He says, if my time has come, I prefer to go now. I do not wish to fall into the hands of the enemy. That's what he said. Ki havikon nicha nafshei. And as his soul was departing, Amar, he said, tahor, tahor. That was his psak. Those were his final two words. Tohor, tohor. Yotzka baskol. A baskol came out for Amra. Ashrecha Rabba Bar Nachmani. Shegufcha tohor. V'yotzka nishmoscha betohor. Happy are you, Rabba Bar Nachmani. You are tohor and your soul left with the words Tohar. That's quite a story. Now, what's interesting is we have to now paskan the halacha. So who do we turn to? Shulchan Aruch did not write about Hilchas Saras. It's not relevant in Chutz Laretz. But the Rambam, of course, wrote about everything. But what we have before us is we have the technology to paskan more or less. We know what's meant to happen. Because there's the machlokas in the Mishnah, and then there's the machlokas in higher realms, and Rabbi said, Tohor, and that's that. The Rambam in Hilchas Tumas Saras, in Perek Beis Halochetes, says, Sofek Se'ar Lavan Kadam, Sofek Beheres Kadma. If we're not sure whether the hairs turned white first, or the skin changed color first, Harezo Tome. That's it. So this Rambam, of course, is very disturbing. Because after that whole build-up, and everybody's happy with the psak of Rabbi Bar Nachmani, and he said, Tohor, Tohor, and the Rambam says, Tomei. How can it be? It's not like Rabbi. Now, of course, we have to remember that the question is not that the Rambam is not paskening like HaKadosh Baruch Hu, which is really also part of the story, because about that we say Lo B'Shamayim Hi, and the Rambam, of course, is a very fierce advocate of Lo B'Shamayim Hi, as is everyone to whatever degree they hold it to be effective. So the question is not how can you pasken like the Heavenly Academy and not like HaKadosh Baruch Hu, but Rabba was yet alive when he said it. So how can you ignore him? And even if he died with the word Torah on his lip, but he said it twice. It's the first time he was alive. And this is a question that has caused a great deal of discussion and debate amongst the Mefarshim. And I would like to share with you two approaches to this question. The first is from the Sefer Iyun Yaakov. Iyun Yaakov is a commentary on the Sefer Ein Yaakov. Ein Yaakov is the collection of the Agodas throughout Shas, Rabbi Yaakov Chaviva. And the Iyun Yaakov is written by Rabbi Yaakov Reischer. He is a great halachic authority, the Shelus Hatshuva Shvus Yaakov, and he has a commentary on the Ein Yaakov called Iyun Yaakov. And he asks two questions, two very interesting questions, and his response is spectacular. Let's begin with the questions. We're in a very difficult situation here. Firstly, Rabbi, on this matter, what was his psak? Tohor, Tohor. Ask the Iyun Yaakov, if you don't mind me asking, why'd you say it twice? Tohor, Tohor. I mean, there are dozens, if not hundreds, of machloksim throughout Shas as to whether something is Tomei or Tohor. And whatever it is, that's what it is. So say it and go. You have to say it twice. We don't say Tohor, Tohor. We don't say Tomei, Tomei. If it's Tomei, you say Tomei and Tohor, Tohor. And here Rabbi Baruch Hani said Tohor, Tohor. Okay, that's an interesting question. One could say, is final psakis allowed to say Tohor, Tohor? And secondly, the Baskol came out and said, Ashrecha Rabbi Bar Nachmani, happy are you. You're Tohor, and you left this world by saying Tohor. Says the Iyun Yaakov, why is that such a good thing? The reason why he left the world by saying Tohor is because he thinks it's Tohor. In other words, he said it's Torah not to say Torah. He said it's Torah because that's the halacha. Were he to have been of the opinion that it's Tomei, so what should he say, Torah, just to leave the world by saying Torah? He has to say what's right. It happens to be that he thought that's Torah. And that's the last thing he said. But if it would be a case that he thought was Tomei, he would have had to leave the world by saying Tomei. And that would be right. So what's the great yichus of saying what he thinks is the right answer? That's all. In this case, it happened to be Torah. But the truth of the matter is, says the Ion Yaakov, this entire issue needs to be opened up, because there is a factor that has not been brought into play, a halachic factor, that should change everything. And it's called chazaka. Chazaka means presumptive status. That is to say, when something was known to be a certain way until now, and then possibly has changed status, chazaka says, status quo holds sway until we know otherwise. That's chazaka. That is halachic inertia. Nothing changes halachic status, known halachic status, without some form of evidence that a change has taken place. And if that's true, then of course we have a problem. And this problem is voiced by the Tosfos in Maseches Nozer. Tosfos have a kasha on everyone. Namely, prior to this whole episode of the bright skin and the white hairs, so what was the person before this? Tahor, for sure. Now, something has happened. Has his status changed? We don't know. So if you don't know, what should the halacha be? When in doubt, follow chazaka. And if that's the case, says Tosfos, I don't understand anyone's position in this discussion. I certainly do not understand the first opinion in the Mishnah. The Mishnah says, if you're not sure, Tomei. Why Tomei? He has a chazaka. He was certainly Torah before. It's a chazaka. And the truth is, Rabbi Yeshua, I don't understand him either. Because even though Rabbi Yeshua said he's Tahor, but he did so by virtue of a special drasha at the end of the pasuk, Letara or Letama will always tend towards Tara. What do you need a drasha for? He has a Chezkas Tara. He was certainly Tahor before. That's all you need to say. And therefore, I have a problem with the position of the first opinion, who says he's Tomei, he should be Tahor. And I have a problem with the explanation of Rabbi Yeshua, who says that he's Tahor by virtue of this drasha. I have enough drashas to deal with. I don't need another one. He has a chazaka and go home. That's a difficult question. And based on that question, Tosfos comes and makes Seder in the Sugya and explains. We need to understand that this entire machlokus, we're not sure, did the hair change color first, etc., etc., this entire machlokus is not talking about a person who was Tahor until now, and did this make him Tomei? Can't be. Rather, we're talking about a person who until now had a certain type of tzaras, which he's on his way to be cured from, and then this developed while he was yet Tomei from the first tzaras. That's the background. And therefore, says the Tosfos, now you understand everyone. Because the first opinion says, if you're not sure whether this is a problematic tzaras, Tomei. You know why? Because until now, he was Tomei. His chazaka is Tuma. He was Tomei until now. Rabbi Yeshua argues with a wonderful chiddush, this drasha of letahara or letamo, when in doubt, you tend towards tahara. However, says the Tosfos, the entire plane of this debate, the entire plane of this dispute, is when prior to this he was Tomei. But if prior to this he was Tahor, nothing to speak about. Everyone would agree that he remains Tahor because of his Cheskas Tahara. In summation, just to crystallize, in cases of doubt whether this is a type of tzaras, according to the first opinion, it depends what you were before. If you were Tomei before, you'll stay Tomei here. That's your chazaka. If you were Tahor before, you'll stay Tahor. That's the first opinion. According to Rabbi Yeshua, you're always Tahor. Says the Ion Yaakov, Rabbah agrees with the first opinion. He does not agree with Rabbi Yeshua. Rabbah said, Tahor, Tahor. Now we had a question. Say Tahor! Why are you saying Torah twice? The answer, says the Iyun Yaakov, is that what Rabbah is saying is, we follow carefully the nuance. When the question is, what do you do with the type of Taras if you're not sure it's Taras? Is he Tomei or Tahor? Rabbah's answer is, Tahor, Tahor. Meaning, if the person was Tahor, then he stays Tahor. That's what he means by saying it twice. If he's Tahor, then he stays Tahor. Now, actually, that reflects the opinion of the Tanakhama. That's the first opinion, that you always follow his previous status. If he was originally Tahor, it stays Tahor. Now, of course, left long enough where the pen and paper will work out that that also means if he was previously Tomei, he'll be Tomei now. And that's the Psak of the Rambam. The Rambam discusses this machlokas, and he says that he's Tomei, like Tosfos says, because he was already Tomei. And that's the Psak of Rabbah. And therefore, this is an unbelievable analysis of this episode in the Gemara, because it turns out that the Rambam is completely in league with Rabbah, because Rabbah has actually sided with the first opinion in the Mishnah, not like Rabbi Yeshua. But what's interesting is, this gives us new appreciation of Rabbah's Psak. Because it turns out that really, if the question is, in a case of doubt, is it Tomei or Tahor? The answer is, it could be both. It could be either. Depends on you. Depends on what you were before. If you were Tahor before, you'll be Tahor. If you were Tomei before, you'll be Tomei. So the answer is, could be both. Yes, it could be both. But Rabbah chose to phrase the Psak in a way that he gave you all the information using only the words Tahor. As if to say, Tahor, Tahor. You understand what that means? If he was already Tahor, he remains Tahor. The rest you can work out for yourself. And therefore the Paschal came out and said, Ashrecha Rabbah Bar Nachmani. What happy are you? That you actually the answer contains both Tahor and Tomei. It depends. But Yotza Nishmoscha Betahara. You were able to convey both sides of the equation by the correct, delicate usage, the nuanced usage of the words Tahor. And once Rabbah Paschal's that way, the Rambam follows suit. So this is really quite something in terms of explaining the position of the Rambam. A very different approach is to be found in the writings of the Chasam Sofer, and it will bring us headlong into the concept of which we are all aware, and we referenced before, Lo Bashamayim Hi. We're looking for the answer to our halachic question. The answer is not in heaven. And the question is, why not? What does that mean? Lo Bashamayim Hi. The common understanding is that it is a categorical issue. It's an essential issue. That is to say, that HaKadosh Baruch Hu wishes for the halacha as we practice it to be fathomed and decided and paskened only through human intellect and through no other agency. Any other medium is disqualified. It is inherently not what HaKadosh Baruch Hu wants us to be the basis of our halachic living. It is a categorical psul. Disqualification. That's what I believe the widespread understanding. There are many who say that. Interestingly, the Chasam Sofer explains it differently. This is the Chasam Sofer in the Tshuvas, in Or HaChaim Siman Reish Ches. It's a Tshuva to the Maritz Chayas. And this approach is also concurred with by the Or HaShulchan, who, in addition to writing the Or HaShulchan, a commentary on the entire Shulchan Aruch, also wrote 6 volumes called Aruch HaShulchan HaOsid, which is to cover all of the areas of halacha that are not covered by the Shulchan Aruch, but are covered by the Rambam, and that includes the halachos of Tzaras, etc. And the Chasam Sofer and Aruch HaShulchan here are both in league, and they have a different perspective on the idea of Lo Bashamayim Hi. According to them, it's not so much a question of through which agency should we arrive at the halachic conclusion. But rather, it's a question of what type of input is acceptable and practicable in a Beis Din. What type of contributions can be made that the Beis Din can work with? And the answer has to be, the Beis Din can only issue a psak based on something that can be demonstrated as a category. And an example of that would be evidence, or an argument, or a precedent, or something like that. That's the problem with a baskol. That's the problem with the heavenly voice. It's a fascinating chasam sofer. The problem with the heavenly voice is not that you're not allowed to listen. The problem with the heavenly voice is as soon as you start allowing a heavenly voice into the Beis Din, everyone in Beis Din will start to have a heavenly voice. And then what are you going to do? Because the side that's losing will pause for a moment and a minute later say, your arguments are all very convincing, but in the meanwhile I've had a heavenly voice and the halacha is like me. And this is actually, it is a short-circuiting of the entire procedure within Beis Din. And therefore this is why the halacha has to be workable. And therefore there cannot be entry allowed into the Beis Din of something that it could be the unraveling of everyone's sanity, certainly, and process within the Beis Din. He has a baskol, she has a baskol, he had another baskol, and the Dayanim, what are they meant to do? It's a very interesting approach to Loba Shamayim here. And in a sense, of course, I mean, there were halachic discussions where everybody heard the baskol. The famous dispute of Rabbi Eliezer with the oven, is it Tomei, is it Tahor? Everybody heard the baskol. Even those that argued with Rabbi Eliezer heard the baskol. The baskol came out and said, the halach is like Rabbi Eliezer, and everybody heard it. And Yeshua stood up and said, we don't care. Lo b'shamayim hi. But there, of course, even though they all knew that the baskol was like Rabbi Eliezer, that may well be. But it now becomes a matter of principle. It becomes a matter of policy. But a baskol can never be allowed in because once it starts, it will never stop. And whose baskol is more mahadrin than the other person's? And therefore, should we ask the question, and this is a fascinating question, does it make a difference which approach we take to Lo b'shamayim hi? That it has to be arrived at through human intellect, so it's more the methodology is the issue, human intellect versus divine revelation, or rather is it more the way the message is delivered? That's the problem. And should we ask, because we're Jewish, what's the nafka mina? What difference does it make as to what the nature of the problem is? Says the Chasam Sofer, what happens if you have a baskol, a divine revelation that reveals to you the psak of a certain person who's not present, but it's a reliable communication of his psak. So now the question is, do we have a problem here? Is this baskol acceptable? Well, it depends. If the problem with Lo b'shamayim hi is that it has to be arrived at through, the decision has to be arrived at through human intellect, it was. He's a human. He's just not here. You don't know what he decided. The baskol can communicate that to you. But it is a reliable representation of a psak from another region, another country. You didn't know about it, and now you do. But in terms of the methodology, it is 100% human construction. It's his Torah mind. But according to the second approach, you can never have input from a baskol. The problem is not the methodology. The problem is, how is the input into the Beis Din, where is it coming from? From a baskol, once again, the whole thing will start up again. Because this person will say, a baskol told me that there's a godl on the other side of the world who paskens like me. Now, how does this affect us? And as the story in the Gemara unfolds, it turns out that people were only alerted to the death of Rabbah bar Nachmani also by a message from heaven. a message came down from heaven into Pumbedisa, which is where the yeshiva was, and said, Rabbi Bar Nachmani his presence has been requested by Yeshiva Shalmala, which was a polite way of saying he's passed away. No one knew that. And they went out looking for him. And they searched high and low until finally they found him. Now says the Chasam Sofer, I have a simple question. If no one knew that he was dead until the Baskel came out, how does anyone know what he said when he died? Tohar, tohar. We know it because the Gemara says it. But in the Gemara, at the time, no one even knew that any of this was happening. Of course, we must conclude that this also was information that was filled in after the fact via the Baskel, by Ruach HaKodesh. So now we know everything. Says the Chasam Sofer, yes, we know everything and we can't paskin on any of it. Because through the very story we realize that the Psak of Rabba, this is an example of the test case. Because the Psak of Rabba Nachmani was communicated to everyone in times of the Gemara via Ruach HaKodesh. As a story, it's unbelievable. As a basis for a halacha, it's unacceptable. Lo b'shamayim. How do you know that Rabbi said tahor? Ruach HaKodesh. Lo b'shamayim. And therefore, says the Chasam Sofer, the Rambam, who has learned the Gemara at least as well as we have. But he goes through the story, and at the end, halachically, what are you left with? A machlokas and the Mishnah. That's all. That's the only thing you know from the normal transmission of information via human beings. And it's a machlokas between the first opinion, who says Tomei, and Rabbi Yeshua says Torah, and the Rambam passes like the first opinion. He's Tomei. Even though, through a baskel, we know that Rabbah paskened Torah. About that we say, Lo b'shamayim. So these are two of the approaches, quite different from each other, but each one opens up fascinating aspects of the issue of Lo b'shamayim, and certainly this most unusual episode within the group. And let us conclude our light discussion this evening by coming back to the idea of tzaras itself. Of course, tzaras, the halachas are involved and complicated, but it's also important to remember that they are a symptom. They are a symptom of a deeper problem, which is first and foremost the issue of Lashon Hara. And it's most interesting that an aveira like Lashon Hara will have physical manifestations called tzaras. Why is this so? And the Kuzari speaks about this. In the Sefer Kuzari, in Ma'amar Sheni, in Os Samach Aleph. And the Kuzari says, and it's interesting how this dovetails with an understanding, which is the Rambam actually says it, and other Rishonim, that the Jewish people have to be on a certain level in order to experience tzaras, ironically. It's only in Eretz Yisrael, and it's only Bezman, as things are as they should be. And the explanation of the Kuzari for this is that ultimately, when the Jewish people are as they should be, when they're functioning at their optimum, their physical appearance is enhanced. If they are spiritually on par where they should be, physically, they look better. The result and the effect of Lashon Hara is it causes the Shechina to withdraw from the person. And the withdrawal from enhanced appearance to abandoned appearance will manifest itself in tzaras. The person going through that process of having had the Shechina, in a sense, inside them, and then having left them, the result will be tzaras. And what we see from here is that one of the effects of a person speaking Lashon Hara is that it causes the Shechina to distance itself. And one of the reasons why that is, which I found to be most profound, is that Lashon Hara leads to fragmentation amongst people. It leads to divisiveness amongst people. Sets people apart one from the other. And that's why the Metzora himself, part of his punishment / rehabilitation, is he needs to be by himself. He needs to experience the isolation that he has inflicted on others. Because Lashon Hara, who, as Rashi says, who hifrid, he caused divisiveness, separateness between people, so he needs to be separated from them. Chazal tell us on a number of occasions that the divine presence only comes in the Jewish people, and we spoke about this when we discussed the V'asu L'migdosh V'shachanti B'socham. Everyone is united. That's when the Shekhinah is connected to them. But when there is period, when there is divisiveness amongst the Jewish people, so then the Shekhinah distances itself from them. Vayihi Bishurin Melech, when is the Melech Bishurin? B'Hisaseif Roshei Am Yachad Shivtei Yisrael. And I saw, in the name of Rabbi Yitzchak Isaac Chover, one of the exponents or proponents of the Toras HaGro, the Gaon of Vilna, explains that HaKadosh Baruch Hu, in obviously in the most external of ways, is compared, his relationship to the Jewish people is compared to the relationship of the soul to the body. That's the Gemara in Brachos and Daf Yud. Baruch Nafshi Es Hashem, David HaMelech says, my soul shall praise Hashem, because the soul, its relationship to the body, mirrors to a certain degree the relationship of HaKadosh Baruch Hu to the Jewish people. Says Rabbi Yitzchak Isaac Chover, a soul cannot reside within a body that's in pieces. And that's why HaKadosh Baruch Hu does not reside amongst the Jewish people when they're in pieces. When they are fragmented. And therefore, when we say this idea, of course it remains to be understood on many levels, but when we say when there is the divisiveness amongst the Jewish people, the Shekhinah departs, because that's what a soul would do. It's a body that's split up into 100 separate pieces. Where will the soul be? Nowhere, in none of them. When it comes together, it can house a soul. And thus we understand that Tzaras is indeed the symptom of the Shekhinah leaving, because it's the effect of Lashon Hara which caused divisiveness amongst people, and once they're apart, so then the soul distances itself. And it's important for us, certainly when we learn the parshas of Tazria and Metzora, because on the one hand there are halachas, and there's Mishnayos about them, and the Rambam wrote about it, and the halachas we need to know. But it's also crucial to realize, accompanying our fluency in the halachas of the symptom, which are very complicated, is an awareness of the root problem, which is not complicated. It's actually very simple. There are other reasons why it's difficult to deal with. And that certainly should be a lesson that if we wish to bring Tazria and Metzora into our everyday lives, so unlikely that we will be met with cases of Tzaras, not the white hairs and not the bright skin, and no rav I know was ever consulted as to what happens if you're not sure which came first. But the halachas of Lashon Hara and Lashon Hara situations, they accompany us the whole time. And if we bear in mind, and very often our response to global problems is sometimes unwieldy because it's a global response. In other words, the difficulties of the world, we feel, can only be dealt with by a world-class solution. But very often, the beginnings of the solution, at least even to larger problems, start with much smaller things, like us and ourselves. I often feel that we are analogous to Naaman. He's in the Haftarah for Tazria. We don't read it when they're together. We read the Haftarah for Metzora. But in Tazria, he has a symptom, and in a sense, we're also prone to suffer from it. Whereby he had his own form of tzaras, whatever that was, and he came to Elisha. Elisha says, dip 7 times in the Yarden. And Naaman thought he was making fun of him. That's it. And he wasn't prepared to do it. He was about to go home. But to one of his servants said, look, if he told you to do something more difficult, you do it. So it's not difficult, so try it. It seemed trivial for him. It seemed to be too easy and too, that's it. And very often, as we consider the ponder the problems of the world, we also see very workable, easy solutions close to home, but we overlook them because they're, for us, they're just dipping in the Yarden. That's it. How can that help anything? There has to be something world class, which of course never comes. My father used to say, it's a Hasidic Shavuot, but it relates to the days of the Omer, whereby the Pasuk says, V'hafta l'recha kamocha. And Rabbi Akiva said about this, of course, Zeh klal gadol b'Torah. It's a great principle in the Torah. And of course, the simple understanding is there. It's an important principle, but the Hasidim say what Rabbi Akiva was saying, Zeh klal gadol b'Torah is, he said it's a great principle, but it stayed in the Torah. He was referring to his own Talmidim, who died during the period of the Omer. That means on whatever level we are discussing them, they are Talmidim of Rabbi Akiva, but they were deficient in V'haftar Recha Kamocha. So Rabbi Akiva looks at the Pasuk, he looked at his Talmidim. Great principle, but it stayed in the Torah. They never took it out to apply it to their own lives. And I thought perhaps that one may add that in this vein, Zeh klal gadol b'Torah, the reason why they didn't take it out of the Torah and apply it to their lives is because it's a great principle. And a great principle, there's something within a person that's inclined to keep a great principle in the Torah until there's a situation that's great enough to warrant bringing it out. And then I'll use the great principle of V'ahavta l'recha kamocha. But of course, what surrounds us every day are small situations. Great principles are unwieldy and impracticable for small situations, and therefore the greatness of the principle in the minds of the Talmidim was its undoing. Because I'm fully prepared to use V'ahavta l'recha kamocha when a situation great enough to warrant it comes about. But in terms of my day-to-day interaction with my fellow man, they're not great people, they don't deserve a great principle. And therefore the fact that it was a klal gadol, that's what kept it in the Torah. But of course the real greatness of V'ahavta l'recha kamocha, its greatness should manifest itself in the fact that it can and should be applied in all situations. That's the klal gadol of V'ahavta l'recha kamocha. We'll leave it over there for this evening.